We get things rolling this afternoon by welcoming back to the show actor and author Stephen Tobolowsky. His brand new book is out right now. It's called My Adventures with God. And with apologies to David Chen, let's introduce him as the man who played Jesco Rollins in the 2007 film Totally Baked, Stephen Tobolowsky.
That's no fair. I have to deal with David Chen all the, if people don't know, on the podcast, we always begin the podcast that David always jokes that I have like 200 or 300 credits to my name. And so he always tries to throw me with this, some obscure role I played. Now this was Totally Baked or Half Baked?
This was Totally Baked, 2007. Yes.
So I shot this somewhere way out in the San Fernando Valley in a bus. I was in some kind of wrecked school bus, and it was a very low budget production. And I asked where my dressing room was, and they said, "Well, it's in the bus too." So everything was in the bus. You change in the bus, you shoot in the bus. Did that film ever come out? Do you know if that film ever escaped?
Well, yeah, I don't know. It appears that it may have been, at least according to IMDb, it may have made it to either HBO or Showtime.
Yeah, wow, amazing. And I believe that was some kind of, they called it a potrimentary.
Yes.
Like, in other words, it was about marijuana. It was a potrimentary when it was like daring to make jokes about pot. Because it was so underground instead of the cash crop of so many new states.
Well, we didn't get you on the line here to talk too much about Totally Baked. We want to talk about the book, My Adventures with God. It is absolutely wonderful. I've recommended it to so many friends. And when they say, well, what is it? What's it about? Can you describe it? And I have a hard time. I describe it, I guess, as part memoir, part philosophy, and part religious text. How would you describe the book?
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to do it. Working backwards, after I put out my first book, and we talked on the show some stories about that before, the editor at Simon & Schuster said, you know, what people like about your true stories, I happen to write these true stories, is the humor in them, but also sometimes the stories have this spiritual bent. Is it possible you could do a second book that is true stories from your life that are humorous, if they can be, but are connected by this spiritual fabric? And of course, I said, oh, sure, of course, no problem. I go, what if I just do kind of the evolution of the spirit in a human life, of the way we relate to the invisible in a human life? And Ben, my editor at Simon & Schuster, goes, great. Of course, I had no idea what I was going to write. And then I came up with this idea, and it was just a conceit that all of our lives kind of do fit into the template of the Old Testament, right? We all have these Genesis stories that we usually tell on a first date with the first glass of Chardonnay about where we came from and who our families were and what our aspirations and our terrors are. And then we all go into slavery, sometimes with our first loves, terrible first employments. And sometimes people just stay in graduate school forever. And then we get free, and we're in the middle of the desert, and what I call, you have a Leviticus moment. And this is where I got married, I had kids, I returned to traditional Judaism in my life at that period of time. And then we're shaped by mortality, like in the book of Numbers. And if we're lucky, we get to the book of Deuteronomy, where we tell our stories to other people to see what this whole journey was about anyway. So that was the arc, the artificial arc I was going to put my true stories on. And as I continued writing, this arc really inspired me. And I thought, you know, everybody I know has gone through this same sort of curve of the way they deal, I mean, certainly the way you deal with God or the invisible or faith when you're a little kid and you're reading Bible stories is completely different from when you have children, and is completely different, like me, when you go into open heart surgery. It changes throughout your life. And I wanted to try to describe the indescribable.
Well, and you mentioned the open heart surgery and also a brush with death with a, well, a non-fatal injury, and those are pretty rare, while riding a horse along a volcano in Iceland like you do.
Yeah, like what could have possibly gone wrong? Yeah, I'm riding on a horse on the edge of an active volcano in Iceland. I end up breaking my neck in five places. This story is in the book. I break my neck in five places, get back to America, and the doctor told me I had a fatal injury, which is a terrible thing for a doctor to tell a living patient. It's very depressing when you first hear that. And then I thought it was funny, but what he told me was inspiring too. And Rich, this is another way the invisible works in our life. This catastrophe that this doctor told me was going to kill me inspired me, because I began thinking, what if what that doctor said was true? And what if I died on that mountain in Iceland? What would I want my kids to know about their dad? And that's what actually started the whole wheel rolling in me writing these stories in the first place. So I say, you know, never trust a catastrophe, because they can easily turn into a blessing before you know it.
Early in the book, Stephen, you share a remarkable dream that you had, a dream of dying in a plane, and then guides to steer you along your next course, beautiful fountains. What did all of that mean to you?
Wow. I was in a relationship at the time with my first love, Beth, for sure. And, you know, we all have dreams. And then sometimes these dreams are very, very real. And in this one particular dream, I was flying across country and I look out the window and I see a plane coming toward us. And I felt the impact. I saw the flame cover me. The plane broke into pieces. I was still strapped into my seat. And I look, and there's miles to Earth. And I began falling to Earth in my dream. And I couldn't say anything. But all I could do was, in my head, say to Beth, my girlfriend, I'm so sorry. I'm leaving. I'm so sorry. And I fall. And how can I describe this, Rich? It's like when I land, I'm in this park. And I remember still to this day, every detail about this dream. I remember the woman who came to help me when I was on the ground. And I said, what happened? And she said, well, you're dead. I said, that's it? I'm dead? and then she leads me through this park to a fountain where people pick what their next life is going to be. Now, I know this is probably some kind of just mumbo jumbo, but through my reading way after this, in fact, after I broke my neck, say 30 years after this happened, I read that in ancient times, the interpretation of dreams was their form of science. And that there were four types of dreams. There is one type of dream, which is just the mess of symbols that we string together into a story that we dream about at night. Certainly, this dream could have been that, even though there was a lot of narrative for it to be that. The second type of dream is when we work out an earthly problem in our dreams. And this could have been that too. But the other two types of dreams, according to the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, come from the realm of God. And the first of those dreams comes from what they call the Malachi, which are messengers of God. And usually they are warnings. And the final type of dream, which is the rarest of all, is actually a real dream from God, and these are called prophecies, and the people who hear them are called prophets. So this was the science of the day 2,000 years ago. And of course, you're stuck as a human being thinking like, well, was this trash or was this prophecy? But I tell you, ever since I had that dream, I could tell you exactly what that woman looked like that met me in the afterlife. I could tell you, I could describe it to a police sketch artist. It was amazing.
We're talking with Stephen Tobolowsky here on Downtown. His new book is entitled My Adventures with God. I was struck by something you wrote, and I want to ask you for some elaboration on this. You write that the primary human instinct is transcendence.
Yeah. I always used to, my mother was the philosopher of our family, and her main bit of wisdom was that self-preservation is the primary instinct. And I believe this with all my heart throughout my life. But then when I was in my 30s, and that's when I was doing my dabbling with booze and with marijuana and occasionally cocaine, Mom came out to visit as a surprise. And while she was there, her presence next to me, looking out at the night sky, I began to realize that what she said and what I believed were wrong my entire life, that self-preservation is not the primary instinct. It never was, because there was nothing about the parties we were having in Los Angeles that were about self-preservation. We were all lemmings looking for higher cliffs to jump off of. And that's when I realized, no, what is man's real primary instinct is transcendence, the desire to reach beyond ourselves. And if you look at it, Rich, we do it in so many ways. We do it with, certainly with prayer, that's obvious. We do it with poetry. We do it with electric guitars. We do it with trampolines. We do it with Broadway musicals. We do it with Santa Claus. And we do it with the poor man's form of transcendence, lying. Because no matter who and where we are, no matter when we are in our life, we want to reach beyond what our lives are to something bigger.
Your mother also gave you some simple but eloquent advice. She said, your life is your life.
Yeah, it. Out of all the advice my mother gave me, good, bad, and horrific over the years, that was the simplest and the truest. And it has stuck with me always, that no matter what, and it goes also, you know, I didn't really realize it until we're talking about it now. In the story about my open heart surgery, I have this very unusual event with time that I tried to explain to the rabbi who's visiting me. And while I was recovering, time had stopped. Mm. Again, another one of these invisible things. I recover from my open heart surgery at 2 p.m. I'm able to see 2 p.m. There's a clock on the wall, and I hear doctors and nurses come in and out of my room. It still says 2 p.m. I fall asleep. I have an entire dream. I wake up. I'm choking. Alarms are going off beside my bed. The clock still says 2 p.m. A doctor whispers in my ear that I'm still too weak and not strong enough to breathe on my own, that there are tubes down my throat. Just relax. They'll take the tubes out in maybe 20 minutes. But the clock never changed. It still said 2 p.m. Always. And I'm trying to explain this to the rabbi that slowly, I could not have survived that time by looking out. I couldn't look out for any point on the horizon of when they would pull those tubes out. I had to look in. That was the only way I could live through that period of time. And it turned out to be 4 hours before they pulled those tubes out of my throat. And what I was trying to explain to the rabbi is I learned that there is no past. My mother is gone. My dear friend Bob, the dear pooch, is gone. It only exists as I remember them. And there's no future guaranteed to anybody, at least nobody in that ICU when I was waking up. There, it is not guaranteed to anyone. And the rabbi said, right, all we have is the now. And I said, no, rabbi, I think that's what I was meant to learn. We don't even have the now. And the rabbi starts laughing and says, well, Stephen, we don't have the past, the present, or the future. We have nothing left. I said, no, rabbi, we have the next moment. You can do whatever you want to do in the next moment. You could rob a bank. You can read a book. You could do whatever you want. But the only things that are going to matter is to tell someone that you love them or to try to undo a regret from the past. That's it. Those are the only things that'll matter. And going back to what my mother said on the porch, that is what makes our life our life. It is the people we love and the regrets we undo in the end. That's all that's going to matter. That will add up to a good and useful and positive life.
so many remarkable people in the book. And I was struck, as I'm sure everybody is who reads it, the amazing story of your friend Abe and your conversations and your friendship with him.
Yeah, it's I still can't even believe that that happened to me in my life. My mother passed away, and being an actor and now recently having come back to Judaism, I thought, well, I am going to do the traditional practice of mourning of a son for his mother or father, which is 11 months of going to the synagogue twice a day, early in the morning, 7:30, and then at 7 o'clock at night. And what you do is you meet with hopefully 10 other people. You have to have a minyan or you go home. And you say the prayer, the Kaddish for the dead. And so you're dealing with 10 unlikely people who are all there for the same reason as you, grief. So I'm scared to death. I mean, it was almost as bad as opening night on Broadway, going there to my first minyan, standing up and saying the prayer for my mother. And this old fella comes up to me. I find out he's in his mid-80s. His name is Abe. And he welcomed me to the minyan. And he says, "You're here for your mother." And I said, "How could you tell?" He says, "It was the way you said her name. I could tell it wasn't for a wife, and I could tell it wasn't for a child." Abe became my drinking buddy for 2 years. Canadian Club and corned beef sandwiches after Minion. We played poker together, and he happened to be a survivor of Auschwitz. 3 years at Auschwitz. And over the 2 year period we were friends, he told me his story. And he even wrote down facts and figures and says, "Mr. Steve, I give you my story. You tell it." And I wrote it, and it is in this book. And it is, I still cannot believe the story of his survival. Mm. And also, it changed the way I view human beings. It is not your typical story of the cruelty that Abe and all the Jews of Poland and Germany, it's not that kind of Holocaust story.
Right.
It's a story you would not believe, that Abe was saved by his German guards, that Abe found love at Auschwitz. It is a story you would not believe. It's incredible. And, I think it's one of the examples of where catastrophe, like the passing of my mother, led to an unexpected blessing. Another way the invisible affects our life. I never would have met Abe if I hadn't gone through that crisis with my mother and losing her. And it completely changed the way I see humans. It still blows my mind when I think about that story.
Your book is titled "My Adventures with God." Well, you put him in the title, and so you write a lot about this, and you talk about it. I think, like everybody, searching for meaning and trying to make sense of it all. And I believe it's the Quakers who look at God as a manifestation of the good that exists in all of us. It's making that choice of good over evil. As you've thought about this, and as you've read, and as you've studied, what do you believe God is at this point in your life?
Well, there's one thing Thomas Aquinas said that was quite beautiful and brilliant, is God is the effect of the infinite on mankind. And at first I go like, well, what quite does that mean? And then I think of the infinite, and I see mathematics, and I see music, and I see poetry, and I see art. And it's very much like what you're saying, Rich. I feel that God, and Aristotle, a polytheist, kind of said the same thing, that the unmoved mover is something that has no time, that is everywhere at all times and at all places. And this, whatever you call this is, this divine spirit has the ability to affect man for the good and has the ability to lead to wisdom. I know that I have a lot in the book because I'm a science guy too. Mm. I'm a guy who's always studied science, and you take a look at the new discoveries in quantum physics. A lot of times, the physicist of like the Large Hadron Collider in Bern, the Super Hadron Collider, where they look at the subatomic particles in search of the beginnings of the universe and the quarks and that made up everything. They can't tell what happens until after it happens. From the effect of the collision, from the effect of their experiment, they are able to tell maybe what happened in that experiment. And I think God kind of works the same way. I take a look at how much good there is in our world because of God. Every piano piece written by Bach, Bach said, was written in honor of God. I tell you, the same thing with Mozart, the same thing with Beethoven, that they wrote their music as a tribute to God. You take a look at the Italian Renaissance, the art of the Italian, the amount of art and music, the science of Isaac Newton was dedicated to God. So it isn't just a touchy-feely thing. It is science as well. So I do think that there is something that is bigger than us that we cannot see. I made a joke to myself, it's not in the book, that to me, God is a lot like my cell phone. Either it's the voice of God is either too loud or I can't hear it at all. And that's what it's like to me. Sometimes I have an event like meeting Abe and I go like, there was some sort of divine guidance that put us in touch with one another. And then sometimes I can't hear him at all, as certainly is evidence in my book through a few decades of my life.
I want to tell you too, we're big fans of the podcast, The Tobolowsky Files. Carrie Haskell, our producer. Carrie, you drove to New Orleans and back. How many different podcasts did you listen to of Stephen's?
Over the course of the drive down and then the drive back, it was about 15 episodes of the podcast that I listened to. I was the overnight driver, so while my wife and daughter were sleeping, you were my navigator for pretty much all through Virginia and Tennessee. But yeah, the podcasts are just amazingly well done, and I just listened to episode 78 last night, and 79 will be out today, right?
And I listened to the whole
79 is all I just before the call today. I checked, and there's one of the outlets that already has 79 out. David and I just finished it yesterday, and I just proofed it last night and this morning, and I love it. And I think the next two episodes, for me personally, I love the next two episodes so much, episode 79 and episode 80, because it's the road trip that I took with my roommate, Jim McClure. And it was an event that, again, Rich, it is catastrophe that turned into unexpected blessings that went all the way through my life into my open heart surgery. I mean, it's remarkable. I hope you enjoy it. It'll come out this afternoon.
Well, I listened last night to The Holy Places, and I loved it, especially as a high school theater director. I love your memories of your director, Mary Curtis, and what a holy place that high school auditorium was for you.
Yeah. I get questions all the time, acting questions, when I travel around the country, and everybody says, what does an actor need to know? And I realize we're in an age of specialization now, and it depends on what kind of acting you want to do. And I mentioned, if you want to be a theater actor, theater requires muscles. You have to develop strength to honor theater's demands. In theater, there is fidelity to the word. You have to say the words exactly as they're in the script. If you are on Broadway and you say a wrong line, you are written up and reported to Actors Equity. It ain't like TV. So I mentioned that there are four holy places in theater. There's the rehearsal room, where you make your first discoveries, and it's the first time that when you speak, you're looking at your partner and you don't see your acting partner anymore. You see the character you're talking to, and you speak not with your voice, but with the voice of your character. That's a holy place. There's the stage, always been holy. Even back in ancient Greece, it was the place where man was to commune with the gods. Then there's the dressing room, which is where we have all of the little tokens of good luck and well wishes from, you know, for me now, decades back of where we get into character and where we prepare to walk out on that stage. And then there is the bar at the end where we go and we drink. And I mentioned that there's one way to look at it, that it's where we talk about all the silly, crazy things that are in the Tobolowsky files, the crazy things that happen on stage, and we laugh about it all. But the bar at the end is special because that is the place where courage is recognized, in that we went on stage today, which is an act of courage, and we told someone's story and we lived to tell the tale. And courage in the past gives you hope that you'll have courage in the present and courage in the future. So I talk about the stage having those four holy places. And to tell you the truth, in film and television, there have been holy moments. And there have been amazing moments that I've experienced just now doing One Day at a Time, the new show with Netflix, being on that stage with Rita Moreno and Justina Macata. There are holy moments on stage, just like in theater, but the places are not holy. The dressing rooms are not holy. The stage, sound stage. When I did Groundhog Day, I was invited back to Woodstock, Illinois, where we filmed it, and they named the corner Ned's Corner, where Bill kept stepping in the water. It meant nothing to me. It was not a holy place. So that particular podcast is dedicated to the role of angels in our life, and as to whether angels are real or not, and how the common places in our life can be holy too.
The Tobolowsky Files, available on iTunes and everywhere you can download podcasts. The book, My Adventures with God, is absolutely wonderful. It is funny. It is thought-provoking. It's insightful. Stephen Tobolowsky, such a treat for us to have you back on the program.
Oh, it's so great to be here, Rich. It's so great. And to all my friends in Maine, big kisses to you.
Thank you,
They're
Stephen.
They're in Otis Field.
We'll talk with you again soon. Thank you, Stephen.
You bet. Bye-bye.